Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast. I'm Eva Monheim.
And I'm Hal Rosner. We are both certified arborists through the International Society of Arboriculture. The purpose of our podcast is to encourage tree planting and proper tree care for our urban forests, which include neighborhoods, parks, and other open spaces.
We will also cover a myriad of tree topics, including the important role trees play in relationship to the climate crisis. Thank you for joining us. We'd like to thank our sponsor, Monheim Microphones. Monheim Microphones designs and handcrafts top-tier studio microphones and preamps right here in the United States in Hollywood, California. Their incredible line of innovative microphones and designs are used around the world by everyone from podcasters to top-charting record producers and singers. They recently released their new royalty microphone, Monheim Microphones Unparalleled Excellence, monheimmicrophones.com. In 1943, founder William Green purchased McCoy Feed and Coal Company, and Primex Garden Center was born. Primex Garden Center is now in its fourth generation of Green family ownership. They offer a wide selection of organic and conventional garden solutions, in addition to two fully stocked tropical houseplant greenhouses, along with annuals, perennials, trees, and shrubs. As the gardener's resource since 1943, Primex seeks to nurture both plants and people through quality, care, compassion, and community. Making your lives greener makes theirs brighter. Primex Garden Center is located at 435 West Glenside Avenue in Glenside, Pennsylvania. This podcast is being recorded on March 31st, 2023. Carrie Russell is a naturalist, photographer, and filmmaker. He founded the Dendro Lab, a platform to foster a broader public awareness of dendrology, and is the author of the soon-to-be-published Tree Identification for Everyone and Why It Matters. As a photographer, he is the author of The New Arcadians, Photographs from Scout Camp, and the upcoming photo book, The Winter Forest. While as a filmmaker, he has worked with director Terrence Malick as an associate producer and editor of The New World, assisted cinematographer Emmanuel Lubetsky on The Tree of Life, and directed and photographed the 10-part documentary series, Tibetan Stories. Carrie holds a master's degree in forestry and is a member of the International Dendrology Society. He's a certified interpretive guide through the National Association for Interpretation and certified master naturalist in New York State, where he is also a licensed trail guide. Welcome to the Plant a Trillion Trees podcast, Carrie. We're delighted that you could be with us today.
Thank you.
And we want to jump right in here and we want to find out how you were actually introduced to the profession of dendrology and ecology, which is a huge part of your life and your background.
Yeah, it probably has to go back. If we want to go way back, I really have to credit scouting with my initial inspiration and just exposure. You know, growing up in a pretty suburban community, having access to scouting and monthly camp out and a troop at that time, and we're talking about in the early 80s now, that where you had a group of really dedicated woodsmen. You know, that was really a part of their upbringing. Basically, my grandfather's generation, they were raised on farms. And their idea about, you know, being in a scout troop was to get the young people out into the woods as often as possible. And I think nowadays, adults that are volunteers, I think that's the ultimate goal. But I think there's just a lot more challenges and distractions in life today that can, on the whole, can make that a little more challenging. And growing up in the era that I did, I just had the great benefit of having that exposure. And then as I got older and I became a counselor at the local scout camp, this is in East Texas, by the way, where I grew up. And the camp where I was a counselor, I ended up being the nature conservation, you know, director. And so there's nothing quite like teaching something to actually learn it yourself as a way of really, you know, diving into the gist and the richness of a subject. And then from there, I was really a creative person at heart. So my education formally took me in different directions. But then I ended up earning a master's degree in forestry. And while I was in forestry school, I was asked to teach the dendrology courses. And kind of that's where formally dendrology and the study of trees really kind of took over as kind of a central theme in my life, which I've laid down or put on the back burner from time to time. But now it's really become like the central focus of my professional life.
That's a really great background. And I know from my own scouting experience and having a mother who was a troop leader, we did a lot of work out in the wild. And there's nothing that can replace that as a child. There's nothing that can replace that. So I can understand how you were influenced by that at a very early age.
Yeah.
You know, I was just thinking with all the guests that we've had over the past few years, how early childhood development in the woods is an essential. We just hear a similar theme over and over again is grandma's house, the creek in the backyard, the farm, the barn, the weekend home up in Wisconsin and things like that. You know, it would be great, I think, for our listeners, Carrie, if we could just get your definition of dendrology.
Sure.
Because if someone asked me, I think I'd really stumble.
Right. Right. You know, and I understand. And, you know, recently I was listening to another podcast that where Richard Powers was being interviewed, who's the author of The Overstory. And, you know, he just dropped the word dendrology, you know, like it was nothing. And I love the idea of it kind of like entering the pop culture, you know, and I hope more and more people will become familiar with it. But yes, we do still need to define it. Dendrology literally means the study of trees. But I would expand that to mean it involves tree identification, tree biogeography, meaning where do they grow and why, tree taxonomy, meaning the naming system that we've given them. And that would entail the way that they're also classified in relationship to one another, and also their phenology. And this is a new word that I hope increasingly will enter, you know, the mainstream. And phenology basically entails the study of the expected cyclical phases that all forms of life pass through over the course of a year. So all these things collectively entail dendrology. And dendrology doesn't include all plants. It's mostly woody plants. So that means a little more than trees. It would include shrubs. It would include woody vines also, but not your herbaceous annuals. That would belong to another you know, category of botany altogether.
Right.
Yeah, because they don't have that wood structure. So we're looking at a woody plant that has something to identify it when it's cut open. You can actually read the signs of age by reading the rings, which are in the wood itself. So I think that's a really good definition that you gave us.
If I can add one more thing to that definition, I've recently come up with this really awkward phrase that I call a parascience. And that certainly is not to be confused with a pseudoscience at all. A parascience is kind of similar to like what we think of as a paramedic, a paralegal, paramilitary. And I used to think that the word para, that the prefix meant under something, but it actually means around, like a periscope. A periscope is not a periscope because it's in a submarine under the water, but because when you put the periscope up, you can look all around in 360, you know, degrees. So to me, a parascience means it's not quite at the level of science where it entails a lot of analytics, for example, but certainly the practice of dendrology is fundamental to so many types of sciences, whether it be a plant science or molecular biology or genetics. And to me, this is not a rub against dendrology. In fact, it's its great benefit, because that means it's incredibly accessible to a really wide range of people. So that's the thing that I don't want people to become intimidated by this word that clearly belongs in the natural sciences, but I want people to know that as citizens, as naturalists, this is something that is like readily available to you to take up as a practice for you and your family.
And it seems like a lot of that then, from the practical and day-to-day applications, is your focus on teaching people tree identification.
Right.
And I lifted a quote off your website, which I just think is lovely, is that, you know, the mission here is to build a community around the shared practice of tree identification as an essential environmental literacy. I love that.
Right.
And again, it's a theme of the show as far as, you know, the hidden language that we're communicating. But can you talk about that a little bit more?
Well, one thing that I've realized, I mean, the three of us, you know, we come from different backgrounds, our professions are slightly different from one another, but all of us would consider ourselves naturalists of one stripe or another. And we've belonged to communities of naturalists for most of our lives. But one challenge that I feel that naturalists have to overcome is that we spend a little too much time sort of preaching or communicating to the choir. Because we feel so deeply the feelings, the experiences that we've had, they run so deeply within us we feel that they are like a foregone conclusion, that they're self-evident, you know, these values. It's kind of the paradox of common sense, right? Well, whose common sense are you talking about? This is actually a very relative thing. So if a person feels that their values are self-evident, they don't often go back enough to the first principles of those values to understand how to communicate those things more clearly to, say, the uninitiated, you know, audience. These are people that I call latent naturalists. You know, on a biological level, like biophilia, they need these things, you know, to the core of their being, but they may not have had the mentor or had the privilege of the experiences that we have had to kind of jumpstart them into having access to this type of practice, you know, or experience in their life, a lifestyle, a worldview. And so part of what I'm trying to create right now, and I'm going to go ahead and drop the name of my group that I've created called the Dendro Lab.
Right.
Part of my motivation for doing this is to return to these first principles, to not take anything for granted. And because I'm in New York City, it's a wonderful place for me to explore this with a community of people that are discovering how much they want and need these things in the post-COVID era. The timing of this could not have been better in a way. And I'm making sure that they understand, you know, why is it that most of us don't know the names of our trees to begin with? Let's start there, right? Let's not assume that the world we live in is that one's not supposed to know these things. It's sort of a Faustian bargain, right? That was made on our behalf centuries ago and for a myriad of reasons that society would accept this bigger, faster, more efficient culture in exchange for divorcing ourselves and our individual lives, you know, from a closer connection to nature. And it was a bum deal. You know, it's based on a false dichotomy, and I'm not even speaking critically of the great benefits that the society has provided, you know, for us in the modern era, but there's no reason why that compromise had to have been struck. And so I'm trying to create a platform where I can go back and find ways to both introduce people to the concept that tree identification can become a thrilling and beautiful portal, you know, not just into learning one's trees, but into developing, cultivating, you know, a life, you know, as a naturalist into their own life, into their own family traditions and rituals, right? So trees are my way of helping people access these, but I certainly hope my ultimate goal is that people don't start and stop with trees, but that this becomes a portal, you know, into a lifetime of learning for them and their family and the values that entails as well.
I'm wondering if this has to do with the seven talents of learning. When I think of your writing, your cinematography, your work in the film industry, visual learners seem to have that connection with nature. And when I was studying literature, specifically landscapes, my one professor said to me that when you go to a new place, because his name was Dr. Pradyuman Chauhan, he was from India, and he said, the first thing you need to do when you move to a new place is to know your birds and your trees.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because once you tie into your birds and your trees, you have connected yourself to the land. And you've connected yourself to the community. I was struck by that. So when I did my master's thesis on Salman Rushdie, I looked at his writings and how he did it. And sure enough, he was talking about the different things that he was connecting into to make himself comfortable in a place where he lived. And it would be a tree, a type of spice, a plant, a flower, a bird, a type of person that he would see selling a particular vegetable or fruit. And that was his connection to sense of place. And I think that that is something that I think about all the time when we start to see ancient trees removed because a highway is coming in or a church on the corner that is taken down because that was our landmark and now we don't have it anymore. Those sensory visuals that we're missing are critical for our understanding of where we are and who we are. And connecting with the giant trees is one of them. And I totally get where you're coming from. And I think the way you articulated that was perfect.
Thank you.
So let's go to Central Park. That must be an interesting opportunity every time you take a new group of New Yorkers out and have them look up and have them look down and have them look at bark and have them look at buds. Can you share how that dynamic looks to you when you're leading a tour?
Sure. I started by creating a postcard, actually. And the postcard on the back of it has a series of little tokens. I mean, imagine it's like your coffee card or your haircut card. Those are the two other, you know, punch cards that I have, right? And on the back of that is a different little token or icon for one of 12 different walks. There's the maple walk, the oak walk, the elm walk. They're sort of grouped by genus because I made a list of the 100 most common native or remarkable or noteworthy, you know, non-native naturalized trees that are still very indicative of the region. And I thought, you know, 100 trees, that's going to be pretty intimidating to most people that are starting at square one. So by dividing them into 12 unique walks, they're basically learning them 8 to 10 at a time. And we're doing them by genus or by morphological characteristic. For example, we do all the compound leaves at the same time, for example, you know, which represents a variety of different genera. And I try to basically create a kind of on-the-ground curriculum, right? A type of pedology, I think that's the right word, like for a teaching style. And I tried to you know, create a system for people that it would be easier for them and fun in a way, you know, because like birding, for example, birding has, I think, benefited from a kind of a gamification, you know, of the practice in a way. We all have our life lists. We have a sense of community. There's sort of a friendly, unspoken kind of competition, you know, within our networks. And I thought, tree and plant lovers need to kind of tap into some of this gamification as well. And so that's what this card represents. People are thrilled about getting their card punched, learning their trees, doing it in a systematic way, in a kind of a thorough systematic way, where they feel like there's a framework and a goal in the process of the learning. And because I started out by referencing my growing up in scouting, I've designed a patch for them that they receive if they get all 12, you know, of their walks punched.
That's great.
And then if they participate in a peer-reviewed field test to see how well they know their 100 trees upon completion of the series of walks, and if they agree to mentor someone else coming up behind them. And by mentor, I mean they make their phone number and email available to answer questions, to be there to support them, because I'm reaching a point where there's only one of me and I need to be really investing more in the community building aspect of this program. And if they do that, if they do the test and the mentorship, then there's a lapel pin that we've designed that they get that kind of makes them a part of a more kind of, you know, winner's circle, we'll say, of people within the community. And people are loving it. They're thrilled about it. They're very excited. And like I said earlier, it's given me a tremendous sense of a purpose, you know, being here in the city as well and to being able to provide what I didn't realize was something of like a superhero until you move to a city where there are, you know, proportionately far fewer people that have a skill, you know, like tree identification, and that I can actually share this with other people brings me a tremendous amount of joy.
You know, you're making people aware of all these trees and learning to ID them, and I think your program sounds wonderful. How does this tie into the larger context of our global crisis, our climate crisis? And you were talking about phenology earlier, which is critical for how I determined that there was some kind of problem as a woody plants instructor, to go out and see things blooming when they shouldn't be blooming, and or they're blooming later than they should be, or plants that never bloom together are blooming together. How does your work fit into that actual crisis?
I've been using the metaphor of literacy and the cycles of nature and just the different, you know, the other non-human members of our community as being like a language. I've been using that metaphor for a while. And I know I'm certainly not the first, but I'm starting to hear it a lot more being used. And that makes me really exciting because it's a wonderful metaphor for people to imagine that if the world is increasingly becoming something like a conflict zone, right? Both figuratively and literally. Imagine what it would be like to be a journalist or an advocate or a healthcare worker on the ground of that conflict zone and not speak or understand that language. So that's what I feel like environmental literacy to me, you know, really, really entails. Professionals naturally have been learning to speak and interpret, read this language on the land for a long time. but we can no longer afford as citizens to leave that to the professionals. So in other words, I'm not advocating that everyone drop what they're doing to become an environmental scientist, but again, take up these basic environmental literacies that were foundational to the formation of all of our cultures and languages. You know, I like to tell people that we actually all come from an indigenous culture somewhere in the past. That culture, though, to use North American as an example, we're not descendants of North American indigenous people, but all of us, if you trace your roots back somewhere in the world, is going to go to a people whose language, identity, and culture grew out of that landscape. And we need to be trying to honor those ancestors and honor that connection between nature and culture that we need to go back and rediscover and find again. The one other answer to that question that I want to give that's a little more contemporary, maybe a little less abstract, is that in New York, I certainly encounter a lot of young people that are climate activists. And certainly this is in no way true only of New York. In fact, I think New York needs to be a better model for the rest of the world in terms of activism when it comes to climate change. But I encounter a lot of very young, very energetic people, but they're being fueled by a lot of anger, a lot of alienation, a lot of fear, and that is super cheap fuel that they're going to burn out on. And as an environmentalist in the 80s, I can tell you I hit a wall as well in my activism, and I don't want to see that repeat. And so to some people, learning something as seemingly simple as tree identification may seem a little Pollyanna to some people, but my pitch to them is what you're really doing is refueling your advocacy and your activism with joy, with beauty, with a sense of identity that's rooted in place. And that is going to take you so much further. It's simple in the sense that it's not complicated, but it's enormously profound, I feel like, in its ability to touch people and to inspire and to really change lives.
I think that your vision is incredible. And I think that listening to you talk, you look at things globally and then you hone in on them locally. And I think that that is important, I think, from the standpoint of being able to recognize who is in your neighborhood, what tree is there, but thinking globally and acting locally, again, that phrase that we hear all the time, translates beautifully in what you're doing.
Yeah, we watch a lot of nature documentaries. By we, I just mean collectively as society. Yes. We consume a lot of nature documentaries. And one of the unintended and negative consequences of this is we tend to think that nature as seen through nature documentaries is exotic and it's far away.
Right.
And I think that's an issue. I think we all need to become a lot more, you know, localized in the way that we think about nature and place as a function of identity and really, really start from there. And even the best of the nature documentaries don't always get us there. You know, I think that the ethics are clearly in the right place of most of the films that I see, but there's still a breach. There's still a bridge, you know, that we need to be two dots that we need to be connecting. And I find that media actually is not the answer for that. It really is about what I call the Dendro Lab NYC. It's kind of the local chapter, you know, where we're doing this community building through the Dendro Lab.
And as Hal would say, boots on the ground, right, Hal?
Boots on the ground, yeah. I was also thinking about something I read recently. I don't remember where, just a gentleman with his own initiatives with environmental literacy and saying, you know, you can walk out your front door, get down on your hands and knees at the sidewalk and begin to observe nature. You know, there's going to be a few ants down there and a little bit of a fungal spore coming to fruition, you know, 14 feet from your front door. So it is interesting. You've made several good comments. You know, the anger and the rage and the cynicism of the younger activists really strikes me. And tamping that down, cooling it off a little bit, if you will, and saying, hey, there's a lot to gain by inserting some joy and thoughtful appreciation of what the world offers us. I'm thinking about the story that yesterday, you know, what Australia just went through with some pretty major legislation and hearing the activists over there saying what a long uphill battle it was to get things through. But it definitely at that point must have been speaking the language that needed to be spoken to the fossil fuel industry so that, you know, some landslide changes could be initiated.
Right, right. And one thing that I want to make clear, I want to back up just a little bit for people that are hearing me, maybe to say that I feel like sort of the ultimate answer, you know, lies within something like having a greater environmental literacy, like tree identification. And what I'm meaning to say is that if we can create a time in our future where we can bake the values of this relationship to nature into all of our institutions, into our economies, yeah. Right? But that has to start with a certain literacy, a certain awareness. So we're really all in kindergarten, right? And so what I'm trying to do is make sure that people within my community have that foundational experience, mentorship, education, that they can begin grounding a sense of awareness that becomes ethics, that becomes a part of their family tradition, that becomes, like I said, baked into our institutions. So it really is a long game that I'm thinking about, and I'm just wanting to go back and pick up some of these threads that I feel like all of us need in order to make that type of future possible. So certainly this is a multi-generational, you know, kind of objective. And so I don't think that, you know, that learning one's trees is the answer to everything, but I am convinced of this. We can't get to a sustainable future without that piece, right? It's not the sole answer. And certainly there is a place where we need more than just, even more than advocacy. We do need activism to deal with short-term issues that require immediate attention. But we can't spend our whole life, you know, being bullet dodgers, kind of all constantly putting one fire out after another. And so that's why in my life, especially at my age, in middle age, you don't have the energy that you had of youth. You don't have quite the same rebellious spirit. Rebellious spirit, yes, but you learn to get smarter in how one applies their energies. And that's why I feel like at this time in my life, I don't even know what I'm against anymore. I just want to fill the space with what I'm for. Right. And then and start from there. And it turns out that what I'm for is helping as many people as possible learn how to identify the trees in their life.
While you're doing your work here in New York, I was watching a video of a woman who is doing the Milwaukee method of tiny forest planting over in UC Berkeley. And what I noticed from the video that I was watching, or actually the film that was live, and they had the children outside putting these plants in, and the children were getting dirty, and they were, you know, putting these trees, and they're just, you could see they were loving them. And the one little child bent over and gave it a kiss. And I was like almost in tears. And so one of the kids came over, put their arm around and said, "We're going to come back and look at these trees. You know, they're going to be here for us." And I was like, oh my gosh, you know, that's poignant. Even if it's that type of activity that, when you touch something, you know something. Right. That kind of thought process and knowledge, how you absorb something. So even when I'm teaching with my adult students, I'll say, touch it, smell it, feel it, so that you get to know it. And that's what these young children are getting to do. And these tiny forests are springing up everywhere. And hopefully, eventually, it'll tie in with what you're doing, being able to identify these plants, talking about them with the children and giving them the context of who these plants are and why they're here, why we're doing what we're doing. Again, going back to what you're doing, bringing it down to the local level is tying people into their community. They're no longer nomads. They're connected to the understanding of that community and those particular plants and those particular root systems, you know, of those plants within Central Park, for example.
Right. There was a woman that said to me recently, she had been a regular in my walks. And at one point, we lived near one another. So we were sort of walking the same route home. And she said, "You know, I don't even know who the person was that 6 months ago thought it was okay not to know these things." And then I thought to myself, okay. And in fact, prior to her saying to that, I can honestly say I wasn't 100% sure what I was doing in terms of what the overall mission and goal and basic objectives were. To me, I was just trying to share something that I knew with a community of people in the neighborhood that seemed to value what I had to share. And the minute she said that to me, I thought, this is huge. This is so much bigger than even I knew that it was whenever I first went into it. So I really kind of marked that day with kind of the proof of concept. You know, on that day, I knew I need to start thinking a lot bigger about this.
So those experiences that you have of leading the tree ID classes in Central Park, and then you, it sounds like you also move up to the Adirondacks on occasion. Is that right?
I do. Well, previously, for the last 10 to 15 years, much of my career was in filmmaking and photography.
Right.
And but I was also a licensed guide by the DEC in New York State, which stands for the Department of Environmental Conservation. It's kind of like our Park Service and Forest Service at the state level all rolled into one. So I'm licensed through them to be a backcountry guide for camping and hiking. And so I would take individuals and families on day excursions or weekend backpacking trips in the Catskills and in the Adirondacks. And in a way, you know, naturally the Dendro Lab sort of evolved out of that. But having to go online during COVID when we were all in lockdown and we weren't able to go on hikes with one another, but the company that I was doing that contract work for, they said, you know, would you be interested in doing some webinars online? And it really it forced and inspired me to become a better interpreter because we weren't on the trail. So I had to get better with words. I had to get better with being more concise and painting pictures with words to help them understand, you know, what I wanted to communicate with. And I realized that, that just it made me a much better interpreter, having to simplify and distill things down to their essentials. And then from that is where, you know, as we came out of lockdown, that's when the work of the Dendro Lab, you know, kind of putting what I learned through that experience with then being back on the ground on the trail again, the synthesis of those two things was really powerful.
So going from being a filmmaker, photographer, cinematographer, and letting the images do the work, all of a sudden you're the guy during lockdown that has to go to a vocabulary and descriptives.
Yeah.
A bit of a jump there.
Yeah. But I'm able to, at least in the webinar format, I'm using a lot of my photography, you know, as visuals.
I see. Gotcha.
So naturally, I still had a lot to learn and to improve in terms of how to communicate these things verbally, but I had the guardrail, you know, of the images that I could use, right? And that, right. that was enormously helpful and continues to be. I still do a free webinar a couple of times a month. And in the process of doing that, it enables me to further refine the information and also to push myself to do more of my own research. There's certainly gaps in my knowledge and experience that this has inspired me to be able to fill. And eventually, and in fact, quite soon, maybe even by the time this podcast is released, on my website, people from anywhere in North America can go to the website and have access to a series of videos that breaks down dendrology for all of North America. I don't think that replaces the community building efforts that I want to encourage other communities to be doing, but I do want to create a better framework for everyone that they have a centralized place that they can go to have the kind of basic instruction that I think all of us need. I think we have bought field guides and downloaded apps by the tens of millions, but none of them have really lived up to the promise that we thought they would have because we didn't appreciate they were just a reference book. It's like having a dictionary in your home and thinking it's going to make you a better writer, right? They're invaluable as research tools, but without the right amount, and it doesn't take a lot, but without the right amount of instruction and mentorship, they really fail to live up to that ultimate promise that we want them to have. I think we buy them much like we buy travel books to places that we might never get to, or it takes us 10 years to get there. But having the book on our shelf kind of makes us feel vicariously like we're already starting to tap into something of that experience. So I want our field guides to be working much better for us. And to get there, I want to be able to provide people that basic instruction. I mean, look, you should not have to be an undergraduate at a college studying forestry or some other plant science to have access to a freshman college level course in dendrology. And that's what I'm hoping my online Dendro Lab course is going to provide for anybody who wants access to it.
I think I need to look at it. I'm going to chase down your Dendro Lab broadcast myself there, Carrie. I think I'm hearing the inner voice saying it's time to freshen up my perspective as well. And I think I also am feeling a slight wave of guilt because I have all these great books behind me. But you know, you think of Dr. Michael Durr's book, Woody Ornamentals, and it's, you know, been the Bible for 25, 30 years. But does it come off the shelf when I'm trying to chase a book down? I have to say, I'm going to be hitting the keyboard and Googling before I pull the book off the shelf. So I think that's been a little bit of a wake-up call, because I remember in college, that would be the book that you would just thumb through, you know, page after page, and varieties and cultivars and natural history and seed germination and stuff like that. So thank you for that little whack to the back of the head.
Sure. And imagine you're a professional. And so imagine what it's like for a layperson to pick up that, or even a more popularly written book. There's always the gist of the reference guide, the field guide, which consists of a simple key and the descriptions and photographs. But then there's always the introductory chapters, which are critical for people to understand. But those are actually, in most, almost 100% of the time, they're not very well written. They're not very well thought out, not for the layperson in mind. And so I feel like all of us, going back to my earlier statement about as naturalists, we have to be careful that we feel that our values and our own education is too self-evident. We have to go back to first principles so that we can pick up these huge populations of people that have been left out of the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's funny. I went to see a client the other day, and I was walking around their property, and they have a woodland. And at the edge of the woodland, there was this invasive plant. It was a Viburnum sibbaldii. And they're kind of creeping in everywhere. And the person, the wife said to the husband, pull out your ID thing. And I said, oh, that's Viburnum sibbaldii. He goes, oh, no, my app says that it's a buckthorn. Yeah. And I said, it's not a buckthorn. I said, and I'll tell you how you can tell. You have to cut it and smell it. And you can't do that with a field guide in your hands or looking at a computer. You actually can tell it by cutting and smelling. I said, do you smell that rank odor? He goes, yes. And I go, that's the sure sign of a Viburnum sibbaldii. And he goes, oh, well, it says here it's a buckthorn. But, you know, there's a case in point of learning just from smelling.
Right.
And, you know, you can't do that on a computer. You have to be out with your team or with your class and really show them how things really function.
That's right.
Or who they're associated with, who they grow with.
Right.
You know, who likes to sneak in with, you know, the maples and the maybe the cherries in an old field,
right.
You know, who are the invasives that might sneak in.
And let's argue for a second that the apps, under some circumstances, work really well, and maybe they may work better in the future. Even still, if a person uses an app to successfully identify something, go back and ask them at the end of the day, you know, what the name of that plant was. 100% of the time, they will not remember, because the app is not helping them to touch it and to smell it and to observe it or relate to it on a deeper level, to hear a simple story about it, you know, that helps them to kind of connect to it in some way. And, you know, that the apps will probably, you know, never do that, you know, nearly as effectively as people sharing stories and creating community together will.
And I love the fact that you're doing that. I mean, you're getting the stories out there, you're showing them, they're touching. That couldn't be any better. There's nothing better than that. And especially in the center of a large metropolis where people walk past moss and this crack in the sidewalk all the time and never even notice that it's there. They don't know that there's nature right underneath their feet, you know?
I think I've experienced something similar here with citizen tree planting and just being involved with tree tenders in the city of Philadelphia in different neighborhoods over the past couple decades, and how with every planting or most every planting, there's going to be one or two persons that really, they get lit up. It's their first time planting a tree, but all of a sudden there's a light going on in this transformative moment where it's very much, aha, you know, look what's happening here.
Right. And how let me add to that while you're on that. What I'm trying to do through the Dendro Lab is experiment with how can we scale that experience that was provided to that young person. That's the conversation we all need to be having more about. How can you scale that and still maintain the quality of that experience and the value for that person? So that is central. That question is what I think about every day in terms of how I kind of prioritize my efforts.
I almost see a urban forestry dendrology mastery charter school, you know, where there is no classroom. There's just a rudimentary hut somewhere in Central Park where the kids meet. but whatever the weather is giving them, that's what they're up against. And you're going to be out there wildcrafting sassafras roots and collecting acorns to make acorn flour. And yeah, scaling up is operative there.
Yeah. I don't have a lot of experience in childhood development or children's education. So where I'm placing most of my, you know, extra time or additional efforts through the Dendro Lab is in better training their teachers. Who are the adults that do have that developmental, you know, experience with children that are already leaders, you know, within different, you know, either the classroom or informal organizations, and helping them to develop their skills training so that they can, that they're already in relation to the young people, can be passing these things on to them.
Yeah, and there is a little bit of catch-up at play in that a city kid isn't going to, from the early onset, unless he's, you know, visiting grandparents in northern New Jersey on the weekends or something like that, but city kids are missing out a little bit. So as they get into the grade school, elementary school, yeah, there's a catch-up sequence I see needing to happen.
Sure.
You know, I always tell the story to my students in classes with ID, and I'll say, do you know what tree the city kids know that the suburban kids don't? And they look at me and they're like, no. And I know that they're all from the suburbs. And the little kids invariably from the city know a ginkgo.
Mm-hmm, sure.
The ginkgo's highly tolerant of pollution, yeah. It, you know. And they see that tree and they go, oh, that, well, that's a ginkgo. Mm-hmm, I know mm-hmm. that. And then the kid who lives in the suburbs, they're usually a red maple.
Right. Interesting.
And the children in the city have never mm-hmm. seen a red maple because it's too harsh of an environment. So right then and there, you say, oh, wow, the kids really are cooking into their yeah. environment. And when we used to teach the little kids in kindergarten, they were the best learners because they will go home and reiterate what they learned to their grandparents.
Mm-hmm.
And they would tell their parents, but grandparents first. They get on the phone and call the grandparents. Grandparents would come over to the school and they'd say, my grandchild called me and told me that they were doing this planting. And they came over to see it, you know, to see what they did because they were so proud of it. And that's how you kind of get you also have the teachers involved, but you also have the kids, and then all of a sudden the family's involved. And that's where the dialogue happens around the kitchen table if they're having dinner every night together. And that's what I think is so important about the work you're doing. You're getting to the root of the family, the children, the adults, the whoever's taking your class. It's working its way down and it's working its way up.
And we can't take for granted that my grandparents' generation, this would be the greatest generation, meaning that's the moniker given to them, right? Pre baby boomers. They, most of them grew up on farms, demographically, mm-hmm. statistically they did. This was prior to the mass kind of movement into the cities where the whole nation, in fact, the whole world became urbanized. So just as I said, most of the adult volunteers when I was a scout in the early 80s, most of them were woodsmen of some sort that had those skills that they had just learned just because it was in the water, you know? We don't live in that era anymore. So that's why those of us that do have these skills and this knowledge, we have to step up. We have to be much more like evangelicals for you know, sharing what we know. We cannot be selfish. We cannot, like I said, communicate or speak only to our choir. I think we need to get really proactive about how can we be better disseminators of these ideas.
And we can't lose that information because once we lose it, it's hard to get it back.
And it's
like learning how to make a fine piece of furniture and you're not working with a craftsman anymore. And who's going to show you how to make it?
It just takes one or two generations and it's gone.
That's right.
I'd like to pivot as we start to wrap up, Carrie, a little bit back toward a question in terms of dendrology or perhaps arboriculture.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're in Central Park quite a bit. You're up in the Catskills, you're up in the Adirondacks. What kind of things do you think about when you're walking the streets of New York City and just pass by the street trees? Because their lives are very different. I just wonder if you have any insights, because I'm starting to look at that microclimate that they have as, you know, kind of sad and unfortunate.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've showed my hand, but...
I think about some of the questions that I ask myself is there's a very small handful as the two of you already know, of kind of these like Hall of Famer, you know, rock star treat trees that are just kind of take all comers kind of trees. You just can't keep them down. But that changes over time.
Yep.
And I'm kind of curious to know what is the future of street trees? You know, what are the new species or cultivars that may really prove themselves? And can we be more proactive about selecting or developing trees that are going to serve a greater ecological function? Most, if not all, trees will serve some type of environmental service, mostly in the form of capturing, you know, rainwater, and also in terms of, you know, providing a cooling benefit and things right. like that for cities. There's a wide variety of benefits that any tree in the ground is going to have. But by having greater ecological value, I'm thinking more in terms of biodiversity. How might we take those street trees and actually effectively tuck them into more of an urban forest? Because currently, we often think of an urban forest and street trees as being kind of two sides of the same coin. You know, they're both serving really important values, but they're somewhat separate from one another. And I think we need to be, as planners, we need to be thinking about how can we tuck all of those street trees into the larger urban forests that we're planting trees that are going to be providing better habitat, better food for our wildlife, and in particular, our bird species. So this is something that I think about a lot in terms of what's around the next corner, and how can we be having the right conversations to be preparing, you know, for a better future where cities are actually can become not just sinks for resources, but actually sources of resources. They can become embassies of biodiversity, you know, or oases of biodiversity, you know, versus just kind of concrete, you know, scabs on the ground. Anyway, I think that what happens in our cities really, really matters. And so I think how we design cities and how we plan for the future of cities right now is really, really critical. And again, what better than to be providing that, you know, freshman or kindergarten level literacy in environmental science for the future that's going to be making those kinds of big policy decisions. So anyway, that was a broad answer to your question. These are some of the things that I think a lot about.
And I think the new infrastructure bill, the canopy cover of each city is critical. You know, are we 20, 30, 40% covered, or are we 10% covered? Right. And what are we going to pick, as you mentioned, what are we going to pick to fill that void? And I think that's a really important and critical topic to talk about. But we're going to turn to one of our favorite questions of our show, and that is, what is your favorite tree or group of trees that you are called to? Or
in Carrie's case, you can definitely ask them, what's your spirit tree?
Yeah, okay. All right, we'll ask you that. Because some people kind of look at us funny when we say
that's
spirit
right.
tree.
Well, not me. Now, it will not surprise you that I've been listening to your podcast and I've loved people's answers for this. And as a dendrologist, I almost felt like a responsibility, like a flag carrier that I had to really like bring my best game to this question. But I am going to demur just a little bit because I have three for you. Is that okay?
Absolutely. We love that. Yeah.
Okay. I'm a great lover of tulip trees. Tulip trees, also called by some yellow poplars, Liriodendron tulipifera is their scientific name. Liriodendron means lily tree, and tulipifera means like a tulip. And it's in the magnolia family. So people just, they couldn't get enough, you know, flower, yeah. you know, metaphors in the naming of this tree. But one thing that I think is remarkable about it is that it is what we call a monotypic genus. So Liriodendron, that genus is in the magnolia family, but there is only one species inside that genus. And that makes it really special to me, it does. Mm-hmm. And historically, what that says to me is that at an earlier time in the Earth's history, that genus was very likely filled with different species that are now only known within the fossil record. And so now it's sort of alone, you know, in the world. It represents a much earlier time in the Earth's history, much like the ginkgo that is also a monotypic genus. But the ginkgo, its history goes much, much further back because it's a gymnosperm and our tulip tree is a flowering tree. So it's actually a relative newcomer on the scene. So that's number one is tulip tree. Number two is I would encourage everyone to reevaluate their relationship to arborvita. This is the genus Thuja. growing up, arborvitae was just kind of like this hedgerow tree of like the least imagination as used by landscapers at the time in the 70s and the 80s. It just didn't inspire a lot for the imagination. But when I moved to the Northeast and I discovered what are in the Northeast, they're called Northern White Cedars. I prefer, however, to call them Northern or Eastern arborvitae, because the word cedar gets tossed around a lot to refer to trees that are actually not true cedars. So the Northern arborvitae tree in the wild is gorgeous. It's majestic. It's a phenomenal tree. And so I would encourage people to reevaluate if they had similar feelings, you know, that left them feeling a little cold when it came to thuyas in the landscape, look to the thuyas in the wild. I think they're extraordinary. And the last one is, I just can't get enough of shagbark hickory. They stop me in my tracks. When I'm on the trail and I see a shagbark hickory, I'm kind of in awe of their form, especially whenever you see a mature one. Caria ovata is the Latin name of the shagbark. And it's just an extraordinary tree. And there's something about its beauty. I think the entire walnut family is a remarkable family. And there's nothing like coming around the corner on a trail someplace and seeing that shaggy bark of a shagbark hickory that just really makes me inspired to be, you know, doing what I'm doing and living the life that I'm trying to make for myself.
Beautiful, beautiful answers. Beautiful selections.
Awesome.
Yeah. Carrie, that's fantastic.
We're delighted that you could be on our show today, and we appreciate all that you're doing, and we hope that you continue your successes with the people that you're working with, that you spread the tree gospel to everyone.
It is a gospel, isn't it?
And
yeah. Yes.
Third
testament.
And yeah, I have a painting that I did called Saint
yeah.
Tree.
Yeah.
Because it is. It's a saint.
If you don't mind me plugging it, the URL address that I have is dendrolab.love, L-O-V-E.
Wow.
Calm was taken.
Wonderful.
And it's fine that it was, because .love, dendrolab.love to me is perfect, because having a closer, intimate, direct relationship with one's landscape is an act of love, and we should all see it that way. And so I'm really proud to have that as my web domain. I look forward to finding you all there.
Well, we wish you the very best, and keep us posted on what's happening.
I sure will.
Up in New
and
York.
Thank you for your passion and your hard work.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. This has been a joy.
I've
really
it.
Enjoyed the conversation.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
The Plant a Trillion Trees podcast is edited by Andromeda and Recordings in Hollywood, California. Oh.